Anyone looking for a mental health clinician with an expertise in narcissistic abuse knows how challenging this is. Why is it so difficult? Thank you so much for joining me today on Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. I'm your host, Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy, a mental health specialist with over 20 years of counseling experience and a narcissistic abuse survivor. I had a lot of trouble finding someone with this kind of expertise. In fact, I fired two different therapists. In this episode, we're going to explain why this is difficult and how to find a potential fit when you're looking for a clinician. You'll hear a mention of Sandra Albarrán webinar, and if you missed that event that was November 15th, no worries. The replay is now available for purchase. See the link in the show notes. I'm thrilled you're here with me today. Remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes and leave a review so I know what you think of the show. And finally, thank you so much to all of you who donate to this listener-supported podcast, because together we're shedding light on all things related to abuse. And with that, let's listen into this replay of a TikTok Live. I'm so glad you're joining me today. I'm super excited about tonight's live webinar with Sandra Albarrán. She actually is the originator of narcissistic abuse field as a whole. She's the first researcher, expert, clinician to define this whole realm of narcissistic psychopathic abuse. She's the OG. I am so excited to be able to talk to her about that whole process, about what led to her to have this massive conclusion about abuse that led her to look into this topic, to go against conventional thinking about relationships, partners in relationships, and what happens between people when there's coercive, manipulative, exploitive techniques going on. What we're going to talk about today, because this is a common topic I want to get into, is I often get asked about therapy. I want to sort of share from the beginning why a lot of therapists are poorly informed, even though when they don't mean to be, why they're out of the loop, and then how to be able to find more appropriate help, and even what kind of help is indicated after we experience a narcissistically abusive situation. I have a lot of experience as a clinician. I was actually trained in the traditional model. So for me, this has been an awakening that I've had to go through. I've had to change the way I perceive what happens in relationships and how this can impact our sense of self and our sense of safety. Why do so many clinicians, psychiatrists, social workers, and psychologists don't know about narcissistic abuse? And what is actually the mindset? So let me kind of discuss how a psychologist or a clinician is trained so you can understand what's happening and why you're getting the bad information when you go seek help. And then we'll get into what kind of help you should seek and when, because there's some thoughts about that as well, some advice that I have for that. When I went to grad school to become a psychologist, we approached it from a Western model. I want to first say that. This is kind of a Western psychology. You're going to hear this philosophy for European clinicians as well as North American clinicians, anybody who's been trained in a Western philosophy. We view you as a solely functioning individual and that you have the freedoms to choose your life, to set your boundaries, and to relate to whom you want to. When you get into a relationship that something starts to go wrong, we view that as contingent on the degree that what your expectations are and how you're handling interdependence, which is a blend of or kind of a mix between dependence and independence. Are you able to navigate the need of yourself against the need of the relationship? How do you manage your individuality against sharing yourself in an intimate experience? And this is a very kind of tricky situation for a lot of people. We're not always very good at navigating autonomy and individuality. And as a result, so clinicians then view that the goal of therapy is to help you get better at holding on to yourself in the context of a relationship, which is really hard. That's a normal, healthy style connection. But in fact, if you came in and started talking to me, and this happened a lot, you came in and started talking to me of what your partner was doing wrong, I would redirect you to your piece of this relationship, the difficulty you're having holding on to the relationship, why you're not addressing the way that this is influencing you or scaring you or your emotional reaction or maybe the boundaries that you're holding or not holding. I would have looked at your difficulty of managing the intimacy in the relationship. I would have almost ignored. I would have kind of put out of my head the partner's interactions, because in my book, you're the client. The other person's not the client. They're not here. And I would have thought to myself, this is what we're trained. You see who's in the room, and I can't make changes to someone who's not in the room. I would have felt that you are putting yourself in a very powerless position by focusing exclusively on your partner, because we can't make your partner behave better or be different or be nicer. We can only do with what we have, and you're in the room, so let's address you. Here's what we didn't understand, and why we didn't understand this, I don't know. I mean, now that I see it from a totally different frame, I feel like it's an obvious, like, wow, I feel stupid, to be honest with you. Despite the fact that we know your sense of self was shaped by your early experiences and your caretakers' personalities and the dynamics around that, we acted like once you became an adult, that process stopped. Isn't that weird? I don't know why we thought that. Like, okay, now you're a fully functioning self, even though how you came to define who you are was based upon how your parents saw you and the degree that they made you feel secure or insecure. But now that you're adult, that doesn't happen anymore. Like I said, it's now that you see it from a different perspective, it makes no sense. We fail to appreciate that this dynamic is continuing to occur in adulthood and for the rest of our lives, that you're never not being shaped by those around you. In fact, if you look at object relations theory, there's a British school of thought and the American school of thought, but some of the biggest writers have been Dr. David and Jill Scharf, very odd last name. They've written, like, their books are huge. They're like tomes on the psychodynamic theory of personality. And one of the topics they talk about, I'm going to like overwhelm you with some big terms, is projective identification and introjective identification. Those are two mechanisms that happen interpersonally between us and other people. Even though we'd been talking about the power of other people's emotions on ourselves, and we even know emotions are contagious, which is why we love to go to movie theaters, is because everyone's experience in the room affects your experience in the room. Somehow, we ignored that when it came to relationship problems and couple problems and family problems. We acted like you're an adult, you should be high functioning, you should be able to completely shape your life experience. So why are you coming in and talking about this issue with somebody who's not in the room and I can't have any impact on? What we now know, though, and this is where Sandra Brown comes in, Sandra Brown revolutionized the field. She said, wait. We are missing the fact that we are interdependent. We affect each other. We shape each other. And we've already known that when we were looking at Stockholm Syndrome. We recognize that when someone's put into a dangerous situation, which where their life is contingent on keeping the captors happy, and whether or not they're even going to get a blanket to stay warm at night, they will butter up and actually, in a way, seem to fall in love with their kidnappers. It's bizarre how we would recognize that this happens in infancy and all the way into adulthood, but we would ignore the fact that it continues to happen even in adulthood. So Sandra said, wait, we need to stop and really look at this relationship. Look what happens in these dynamics and see whether or not that one person, if there's a power inequity, can impact the other person and affect their functioning level. And there you go. That's how we got into this whole topic of narcissistic and psychopathic abuse, relational harm. She calls it relational harm, that one person can set the tone and create such a toxic environment, such a dangerous environment, that the other person's functioning, even cognitive functioning, even the way that the degree that they're able to organize their life, see themselves, their sense of reality can be shaped by the one who's being scary, being intimidating, and being abusive. And there we ushered into this whole field. But this is a field that's not even, I think, hardly in its infancy. I mean, if we were to say, like, psychology as a whole, let's just look in perspective. Psychology as a whole really started kind of theorizing and developing in the early 20th century. You have the big names like Adler and Skinner, Freud, Winnicott, Kernberg, all these big names. And that all happened in a period of time from like 1930s to the 1960s and 70s. And then in the middle of all that, neurobiology started to catch up and say, wait, not only is this happening in the way that we think about ourselves, but you can map it in the brain and see it in the brain. There is a connection between thought and neurology. Like, are we surprised by that? Of course there is. All of this growth has just happened in less than 100 years. And then Sandra Brown comes into the scene about 2000, I mean, just recently, and starts to do this massive research into this whole topic. If we were to say that psychology is a baby in infancy, I would say narcissistic abuse is still screaming in the operating room with the doctor. It's so new. There's so little really understood about it. We're just now starting to unpack what cognitive dissonance is and how to treat it. We're still unpacking exactly what happens with love bombing and trauma bonds and how do you break a trauma. We're right now just beginning to start to understand this from a psychological, sociological research standpoint, which again is why I really think that you should be here tonight with Sandra L. Brown and hear the original thinker, the original pioneer in this whole arena. That means that most clinicians have not been trained. They've not heard of the word. They don't know the lexicon that we're talking about. It's all new to them because it's not even in a DSM-5. There's no recognition of this as a issue, a thing. There's no diagnosis. We call PTSD and CPTSD, but let's be honest, that doesn't really capture well what we're going through. That we're sort of that, but a little bit different. Does that make sense what I'm saying? It's kind of like that, but there's a slant in it. It's a unique slant on it. We certainly don't hold offenders responsible. There's nothing about this at a, you know, a legal standpoint. We're now even saying, is this domestic violence? And yes, the answer is it's coming out to be show that it's one of the worst forms of abuse, actually, because of the decompensation of self that occurs, the erosion of confidence and reality in self, with actual neurological damage that happens to victims. So yes, it is actually an abusive experience, but there's so much that we still don't understand. One of the first books I read as I was leaving in the narcissistic relationship was Why Does He Do That? By Lundy Bancroft. Mr. Bancroft spent most of his life's work trying to understand the angry and controlling male mind. Reading through his profile descriptions of abusive men validated what I had just experienced. It confirmed that I had gone through something terrible and helped me understand that it wasn't my fault and that I hadn't done anything to deserve the abuse. It is my great pleasure to announce that I'll be interviewing Lundy Bancroft live February 9th. Learn who abuses and why. What is the effect of abuse on our children? And how do we know when it's time to leave? Come be my guest for this 90-minute webinar and learn firsthand more about abusive men and their relationships. For the final 30 minutes, you get to anonymously ask Mr. Bancroft your questions. Early bird tickets are now on sale. The price is going to go up after the new year. This is a must-see event, and all ticket holders will leave a complimentary replay of the event. So what are we supposed to do when you're looking for help? Well, I have some suggestions based upon the continued education that I do. And I have taken Sandra Brown's seminar, and I've also taken Dr. Romney's seminar and all the latest critical thinkers. I've been involved with like 20, 30 hours this last year of continued education with these individuals and doing a lot of reading and research of my own. I can make some recommendations of how to begin to find help and what therapy should look like if you find yourself in this type of a situation. First of all, if you're in an abusive situation, please do not get counseling with your partner. I know that's the first thing that we recommend when you are in a troubled marriage or a struggling relationship. And yeah, that's true. If you came in off the road and was talking to me about having difficulty with simple communication problems, being out of sync with your partner, you know, the typical average stuff, maybe organizing your finances or planning, maybe like making life goals together, I would say to you, couples therapy has indicated that it would be very, very helpful to improve communication between the two of you and cement some better couple goals and learning how to negotiate the struggle between individuality and intimacy. That would be very typical. Or if you came in and talked about a few kind of sexual hiccups you were having, I would send you into a sex therapist, maybe a therapist with a specialty of both. That's just standard recommended treatment. But if you came in and start showing me signs that you were feeling afraid of your partner, that you had modified yourself, you weren't even sure who your partner was or if this is a good relationship or not, I now know to recognize that as signs that you're probably being emotionally abused. I wouldn't have 10 years ago, never even heard of the topic. Here's one more thing I want to add. Here's the other shocking part about graduate training. I bet you didn't know this. Did you know there is not a standardized graduate study for psychologists? It depends on what your focus is. So there actually is this huge book called Graduate Studies put out by the American Psychological Association, what I use to find my program. It lists all the programs in North America, along with their entry requirements, the costs, the programming, what it looks like. But each program has so many candidates that allows in, so many students that are in that program, and each program has a specific specialty. They're not the same. Some will specialize in research only. It may even be bioneurological research only. Others might be studying, maybe they're very into behavioral. They're going to teach you how to affect behavior in a person, change behavior. Another program might focus exclusively on the psychodynamic theory or cognitive behavioral theory. Every program has a different study. And the book is, again, it's called Graduate Studies in Psychology or something like that. If you go to American Psychological Association site, you will find it there. It's listed there. And I think it's even, there's an online version of it. But that's how you find programs in the United States. But there's not programs that specialize in abuse. That's too specific of a topic. But you can find programs that specialize in family work, that's possible, or counseling versus clinical versus school psychology versus forensic versus organizational psychology. See, psychology is massive. It's very huge. But you're not going to find something that specializes in personality disorders. In fact, most graduate school training spends almost no time to nearly no. Maybe they bring it up in psychopathology. On personality disorders, when they're going through the DSM-5, they may say, oh, and in addition to depression, anxiety, and schizophrenia, here's personality disorders. But you're going to find it's a rare program that spends much time on personality disorders. My program back in the 80s, thank God, was on the cutting edge. It still is. It's a fantastic program. I think the world of where I graduated from, and we spent a lot of time on it, partly because they'd hired adjunct faculty who actually wrote books on the topic. So I was getting the material from people who were thinkers, writers, experts in these topics. So I happened to get in the 1980s, which is wild because if you know when the DSM-3 came out, that's when we even first created the diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder. I was right on the edge in being able to learn about personality disorders. Now, my understanding of it was taught from a developmental standpoint, not from a biosocial standpoint. So I've had to get up to date on what the research is, what we're thinking about the cause, the etiology of personality disorders now. So I say all that to say, that's why you're struggling finding a therapist who knows a lot about this topic, because most therapists haven't received specialized training in personality disorders, and the topic of narcissistic abuse is new. So you are struggling. Maybe you've already realized that you're in a relationship with a partner who has narcissistic traits, although you can't diagnose them, but you realize that you're in a relationship with somebody who's got traits and you need help. What are you supposed to do? Here's how I suggest that you find a clinician. And this is why I often recommend coaching over clinicians, because a lot of coaches have come out of their own experiences and then decide to get an expertise in this area, which is why then they're focusing on it. Now, I'm not saying coaches and therapists are necessarily the same, but I think sometimes the crossover is very wide and very generous, and you can do well by a coach, maybe sometimes in lieu of a therapist. But this is how to find a therapist with a specialty in this topic. You want to ask them a few test questions. First of all, change the mindset that you go in when you're looking for a therapist. I know, I still feel it when people meet me, and I wish they didn't do this, but I do it too, so I get it. They find the word of psychiatrist or psychologist intimidating. People think that I see through you and that I know things that you don't want me to know. Well, yeah, I can't not see what I see, but I'm not sitting around. Think about it. Do you go home and work? I'm not working. I don't want to work when I'm off. So I'm not going around and trying to cure the world or analyze you. But I know that when you step into the office, there's a power inequity. You know you're paying this person for their training, their experience, their knowledge, and their expertise. And what happens when we go into that mindset, we create a power inequity in which they are higher than we are. And we assume then that they have authority and that they know better than we do. So I'd really like to have you change that. But be really aware of this white coat syndrome that we often have. I have it too. I'll tell you, I sit down with a social worker and a psychologist. I'm intimidated. Sometimes I have more education than that person and I'm still intimidated. I know it's a very natural thing for us to do, to view the power inequity, but I really want you to change the mindset. And this is how to do it. When you go into that appointment, I want you to say to yourself, I'm interviewing this individual. This is an interview and I'm making sure this is a good fit. Just by your reminder of that reminder to yourself will help you set the tone and set the frame in a different way so that you give yourself a little bit more power when you meet this person. And I also want you to think of that you're going to be asking them some big questions that they have to answer correctly. And if they can't answer these correctly, no shame, no criticism to them. It's just not a good fit. So here's the questions. I'm going to slow down. So if you want to write these down, you can. The first question you want to ask is, ask them directly how much they know about narcissistic abuse. Have they ever heard of it? Just flat out ask them that. And then say, do you know the words that most people on social media are using about narcissistic abuse? Do you know what it means to be hoovered? Have you ever heard of breadcrumbing? What do you know about love bombing? Just ask them these test questions. It's about the terminology. Somebody who knows something about this should know those words because that means that they have been in this realm and have been studying and listening to you, to this topic, to Dr. Romani, to Sandra L. Brown. Flat out ask them. The next thing I want you to ask them, and this is a trick question. Explain to me who a codependent person is. Okay, let me tell you why that's a trick question. I know it's popular here to think that's a fair way to describe victims, but it actually is inaccurate. It comes out of addiction models, out of codependency refers to what happens to loved ones around the addict when they start to try to manage the addiction so that it has less damaging effects on the family and on the relationship. They become ill together with the addict. They used to call it co-alcoholic. Now they refer to it as codependent. It wasn't until Melanie Beatty's book, Codependent No More, that it shifted and started describing any kind of excessively accommodating relationship. But really, that's an unfair use of it. It misunderstands the dynamics of what happens in a toxic relationship. Yes, enablers would be another word that's used for codependency. Again, enabling has to do, you enable the addict. You enable by protecting them from the worst negative consequences of their addictive behavior. That's where it comes from. It's a fuzzy term that doesn't mean anything. There is no research on it. There is no firm definition. It's not in the DSM-5. And it actually has become a way in which we attack and slander victims. It's a way for us to say it's the victim's fault for what happens. No, it's not. And when you understand the dynamics of what happens in abuse, in this emotional, exploitive, deceptive practice that happens between an abuser and their target, you'll understand why the target is actually no longer in power and no longer aware what's happening to them. They're not enabling. They're being duped. They're being conned. They're being hypnotized and mesmerized. So we're holding someone accountable for the hypnosis of themselves. And that actually is sort of kind of doesn't make sense. If you're being mesmerized and duped and conned, you're not accountable. You can't be accountable for that. That's why I think these terminologies, they're used actually by predatory people as a way to kind of dismiss what they've done and to distract from the problem of looking at their behavior. That's why I really have problems with this language. So ask them that. And if they begin to tell you, well, codependent is anybody who's people-pleasing and not set good boundaries, God bless that a clinician, but please don't stay with them because they're not going to give you good help. They're going to gaslight you and make you feel responsible for the abuse that's happening to you. And I don't want that happening to you. That's going to make you feel crazier and worse than before. And I know because it happened to me, for one, so I know what it feels like. But two, a lot of you DM me and tell me what your experiences are like and how awful those experiences have been and how not helpful and how much worse you felt after you got that kind of therapy. So please ask that test question. And if that's how they respond, then this is not a match. What you want to ask them is, are they betrayal trauma informed? Betrayal, like you've been betrayed. Betrayal trauma informed. That's the new thinking that's come out, probably started coming out about 15 years ago. It has to do with what happens in psychological relationships when there is this massive betrayal of one partner by the other, when they have actually created a whole system, like almost like a double life, and they lead you to think that this is what this really is happening in the relationship when it really is this. They make you think that they're invested when they're not. They make you think that they're monogamous when they're not. They make you think that they love you when they're actually not loving you at all. And they're doing deceptive things behind your back that are betraying and undermining the relationship. That causes a trauma called betrayal trauma. You're being traumatized by this chronic betrayal that's happening to you. And you may not even be aware of the trauma. It can be, but you're aware at some level, which is causing all of the like angst and uncertainty and confusion and the mental fog that you're feeling. You're sensing it at some level, but you're not really maybe being fully aware of the complete deception that's happening. So you want to ask, do they know about narcissistic abuse? You want to ask, what's their opinion about codependency? And are they a betrayal trauma informed specialist? That's what you do. Now, the last thing you want to look for is how does this, and this is always true about all therapists, okay? Irregardless of what you're looking for, you may be looking for maybe an ADHD specialist for your child. Maybe you're going in because you're really struggling with anxiety symptoms. But so this is just good advice for everyone looking for a good therapist. How does this make you, how does this person make you feel? Are you feeling safe? Can you bring up the stuff that's really tough, that's uncomfortable, that you feel ashamed saying out loud? How do they respond? How do you feel about how they respond? Do you feel supported? Do you feel like they're listening? Do you even feel listened to? Do you feel like you're being judged? If you're not feeling safe at all these realms, then please, please, this is not a fit. You want somebody who really creates the mental space, the emotional space for you to bring everything in. Well, now that you've listened to this podcast, I would love to know what has been your experience with finding a therapist. Was it tough to find someone informed about the nuances of narcissistic abuse? It can be challenging to find someone with the sensitivities to the unique issues that we face. Remember that you're interviewing them, the new clinician, as much as they may be assessing the fit with you. And be sure to look for understanding and safety. I hope you have a great weekend. I'll see you back here on Monday. Bye-bye.